So we're into our final portion of the evening, and I do want to make one other thank you to Robert Nana, who has volunteered all day to do the AV in the back. And Robert, would you stand up for a second so people can see who you are? Thank you, Robert. Okay. Okay. So it gives me really great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Richard Gage, AIA, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Richard Gage is a San Francisco Bay Area architect and a member of the American Institute of Architects. He has been an architect for over 23 years and has worked on most types of building construction, including numerous fireproofed steel-framed buildings. Since founding Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth in 2006, Gage has presented Blueprint for Truth all over the world, and he has appeared on radio shows and television spots. And it is with great pleasure that I introduce Richard Gage.
Thank you. What a sweet, warm welcome. I appreciate that so much. Good evening, and thank you for your courage and your willingness to reconsider the very difficult subject of the World Trade Center and the staggering loss of life on 9/11. Relative to Building 7, we don't have a staggering loss of life, but we'll see what we do have. It is the key to the understanding and exposure of the staggering loss of life. Just as architecture and engineering projects are sometimes quite joyful, sometimes extremely difficult, this particular project has proven to be one of the most difficult. And not difficult in terms of reaching conclusions, though, but because of the implications of those conclusions and finding people open-minded and willing enough to actually consider the forensic evidence that we're looking at today, re-examine these facts about the destruction of the high-rise. Our commitment to you tonight is to speak the truth and leave you with extremely valuable science-based information. I believe that you'll come to an updated understanding tonight as to what is science and what is conspiracy. But please, check out the facts, all the facts that you hear tonight. We're not looking for believers. Do your own research, because it's extremely important to find out the whole truth about the 9/11 event. After all, it served as the pretext for the invasion of two countries in which already over a million people have perished. And the ensuing global war on terror and served, of course, to a host of other ills that we're suffering from as a nation today. If all this remains intact, we will suffer. And if we continue to ignore or sweep the truth about 9/11 under the rug of history, that will happen. And only the truth about 9/11 will stop another 9/11 type attack from happening again. We must dedicate ourselves, therefore, to finding out exactly what happened and why, and bringing those actually responsible to justice. So these are among the many reasons that we must peer into this painful part of our recent world history and re-examine the relatively new physical evidence that we have from 9/11 that we've not seen in the mainstream media. As one of our mentors, Joe Princiota, points out, to identify the perpetrator, first know the crime. And that's what we focus on tonight, the evidence found at the crime scene, the eyewitness testimony. I've been an architect for 23 years in the local Bay Area of San Francisco. I'm now devoting 100% of my time and energy to this cause, and tonight you're going to see why. But like many other architects, I've designed numerous fireproof steel frame, buildings like these schools and this mall, the day-to-day construction administration for this $120 million high school. And more recently, this $400 million project in Las Vegas with 2 million square feet of retail, parking structure, and fireproofed steel-framed mid-rise office space with over 1,200 tons of steel framing. So regarding our mainstream media. Once in a while, we do get some truth into it, as you saw the Geraldo clip earlier this morning. Time magazine reports that many Americans, up to 36%, according to this poll, in 2006 by Scripps Howard, Ohio University, want a new investigation. They say, Time magazine concludes, it's not a fringe phenomenon. It's a mainstream political reality. Well, that's comforting news for those of us who've been screaming into the wind for 10 years. We'll try to make that come true. Now, most places I go, I will ask, in fact, I'll ask tonight, how many of us tonight have not heard of Building 7? Let's just first get a show of hands. Okay, so you've been here all day, you've learned something. Is there anybody who believes the official story at this point? Don't be intimidated, but believes that Building 7 came down according to normal office fires, the official story. Real high. Is anybody unsure still? And the rest of you, controlled demolition? Yeah. Okay, so we're speaking to a unanimous crowd. Now, I speak all around the world, and we've spoken about 160 times or so to groups of 100 to 600. And I'll always ask how many people believe the official story about the Twin Towers. And we'll get, in a crowd of 200, we'll get maybe a couple of dozen people who believe the official story, maybe three or four dozen who are unsure, and the rest, like you guys, are controlled demolition. You've lost all your friends. They won't talk to you anymore. You come here alone without anybody and looking for inspiration. But by the end of the evening, we will have easily 90% average of those people who were skeptics or unsure move off their position agreeing with us and calling for a new investigation by the end of the evening. So it's pretty comforting. Now, NIST claims that they found no evidence for explosives. So later, they acknowledged that they never looked for it. Well, how can you find what you're not looking for? But thousands of architects, engineers, others have looked for it, and it wasn't that difficult to find, actually. We've been speaking about it now for 4 years. If 1,000 architects and engineers were telling you that your house was in danger of collapsing, would you listen? I'd hope so. That's what we're asking tonight, is that you listen. How many architects are here tonight, by the way? And did William Brunier make it? I saw his name on the list, but I don't think he actually made it. How many engineers? Watch this, they outnumber us completely. How many normal people? Okay, good. Well, the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth are not conspiracy theorists. We don't bring you theories or politics. We're looking at the science-based forensic evidence. And so we'll take a look at that today. In fact, on the right side of our website, you can see the bullet points of evidence with references to other interesting websites. We mostly steal stuff from other people at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There's been an incredible body of researchers. We came on the scene late, and everybody else is doing the work. All we really do is assemble it and get it out and package it so that it can be readily understood. So we're encouraging you to make best use of the website as a resource as well. What we want to encourage everybody to do is follow the scientific method. How does that work? What we do is we have a question. How did Building 7 come down? Through fire? did it come down through controlled demolition? So we have a question. We do research, background research. We make observations about that research. We construct a hypothesis, our best guess as to how the building came down. We test the hypothesis with experiments, and we analyze the results and draw conclusions. Now, if the hypothesis is corroborated, we report those conclusions in an open, transparent manner. And I think you've seen through the course of the day how open and how transparent NIST has been relative to this application of the scientific method. But if your hypothesis, which is not very much for those of you who missed that lecture earlier, if the hypothesis is not corroborated, we go back, we construct a new hypothesis, find out what fits the data, the evidence. And so that's the process which will take you through quickly today. And in the two-hour DVD, which is available tonight, you can take a more leisurely look. Well, starting with background research, let's take a look at what does and what has destroyed buildings before. Fire is certainly one example. We'll take a look at that. And earthquakes, a natural collapse mechanism for some buildings, a force applying lateral loads sideways to buildings. Explosions destroy buildings, okay? And controlled demolitions, which use explosions to destroy buildings. These are all among those forces. So unlike NIST, what we want to do is take an examination of that. Fires, for instance, they travel through a building in a given area every 20 minutes or so, burning out one area, looking for fresh new fuel sources, leaving it to cool behind and heating up the next area. So when a building does collapse due to fire, we see large gradual deformations. Asymmetric collapses, the building will fall in sections, it'll fall over, twisting, turning. It's not an engineered-looking phenomenon. And by the way, never in history have we had a steel frame high-rise or any frame high-rise collapse due to fire, even though there's been 100 examples of such. Now, let's see what we would expect fire to do in a steel frame building, because there has been some tests, as you've heard earlier. Let's take a look.
The way in which steel-framed buildings behave in fires depends on their construction. In this test, done by British Steel in 1995, a large amount of typical office furniture. The way in which steel-framed buildings behave in fires depends on their construction. In this test, done by British Steel in 1995, a large amount of typical office furniture was burned to see what would happen to the heavy steel beams that supported the ceiling.
When steel is bare, when it heats up, it gets weaker. It's not that it melts in a fire. In fact, normal fires are not hot enough to melt steel. Even if you were, for example, to use an unusual fuel like kerosene, you cannot achieve temperatures hot enough to melt steel. But what happens is it starts to lose its strength. And as it loses its strength, it starts to sag. It becomes softer and sags and can no longer support the load.
This was the largest test of its kind ever conducted. It showed how unprotected steel can be distorted, even by a normal office fire. But as is typical in steel buildings, the structural beams only slowly and progressively warped and sagged. There was no chance of a sudden collapse.
In over 20 years, I have not seen, until recently, a protected steel structure that has collapsed in a fire.
Until recently. That was 9/11, by the way, when we had three steel frame skyscrapers collapse rapidly primarily due to fire. So this is pretty important research, wouldn't you say? Was this study referenced by NIST in their examination? No. This didn't even have fireproofing on some of those beams, just slow sagging. As I think it was Kevin Ryan who said that when there's thermal expansion, the path of least resistance is to sag, to go with gravity, not to extend out. Unless, of course, you apply all of the heat to that beam in your computer model in the time frame of about 1.5 seconds, which is not natural whatsoever, of course. Here's some examples of those high-rise fires. In New York, we have a 6-hour fire over 5 floors. L.A., 3.5 hours over 5 floors. 18 hours over 8 floors in Philadelphia. And in Caracas, Venezuela, this building burned for 17 hours over 26 floors. Did any of these collapse? No, not one of them. Now, these are buildings that fell over, in some cases, somewhat of a pancaking-style collapse. But what we see is a building at the base of these of the destruction. The structural components haven't dismembered from each other. The concrete is not pulverized to a fine powder. This is really important information for us to consider in our application of the scientific method. These buildings exploded. We have witnesses that heard sounds of explosions. They see flashes of light. There's thick, billowing, enormous clouds of pyroclastic-like smoke with pulverized solids suspended in the air in cauliflower-like formations due to the intense heat from the hot gases from the explosives. If we see this kind of stuff, we're really sure that we have explosion. The fires don't do that either. Pyroclastic comes from volcanic eruptions. So let's start by looking at some of the facts about controlled demolitions, because they have a set of features that are common to them that we would want to compare in any proper use of the scientific method to try to understand Building 7. We have a sudden onset of destruction at the base of typical controlled demolitions. And here's what they look like. We have hundreds of examples from all across the country from which to make our comparison, because it's the most commonly used method to bring down high-rises. So this is what a high-rise looks like when it's being brought down with explosives. Now, they can be engineered in many different ways. Normally, the purpose is to remove a structure while avoiding damage to adjacent structures, and to do so economically. So typically, a tall building like this is demolished by placing thousands of cutter charges throughout the columns and beams in the building, and then detonating them in a very precise order, starting with the interior structure and progressing outward, and starting with the lower floors, progressing upward, synchronistically timed, floor by floor. Destroying the interior columns allows the unsupported weight of the building to be harnessed to do much of the destruction, turning that potential gravitational potential energy into kinetic energy. The result is an implosion, producing a vertical, symmetrical collapse at free fall acceleration, or very, very near so, into a consolidated rubble pile that's broken up and ready for loading and shipment. Now, this is a feat that only a handful of companies in the U.S. can accomplish. And guess what? Fire never has. So, let's take a look at the features. What do we have? A sudden onset of destruction at the base, usually. A straight down symmetrical collapse into its own footprint, because it's engineered to do just that. How do we get that? We have demolition waves that remove those column supports. This results in a free fall acceleration, an unresisted drop to the back, to the ground, through what was the path of greatest resistance, the thousands of tons of structural steel framework in the building. We have a total dismemberment of the steel structure, so it's ready to be loaded and shipped off. We have minimal damage to adjacent structures because we've pulled the building inward away from those other surrounding structures. We have witnesses. They see flashes of light. They hear sounds of explosions. We have enormous clouds of pulverized concrete and what appear to be squibs sometimes, high-speed isolated ejections of dust and pulverized building materials, charges that go off, perhaps at the wrong time. We have chemical evidence of charges, of course, in the debris pile. These are all typical, and they constitute direct and indirect evidence of controlled demolition. Now, guess what? Fire can't accomplish any one of these features, let alone all 10 of them. So if we have any of them, we know we have a controlled demolition. If we have all 10 of them, we're really, really, really sure. This is called proof, especially if it's backed up by government documentation, which we'll be looking at in a moment. Experts agree, yeah, that's a controlled demolition. Foreknowledge, because these are planned months in advance. You don't do a controlled demolition on the day of an event like this. And video documentation. So is this proof? Pretty much so. Let's apply that background research now, which NIST didn't do, to Building 7. Building 7 was 47 stories tall, easily the tallest building in most of our states. It wasn't hit by an airplane. It only looks small relative to the tallest buildings of the world that it's adjacent to up until, 1970-something, there was the Sears Tower outgrew the Twin Towers. Now, this building collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon. It was the third high-rise to collapse, a football field in length away from the Twin Towers. And you can see it is surviving the collapse of the South Tower adjacent to it here. And beyond the aftermath of the South Tower, there it is. The fires started later, 1 o'clock, maybe 2 o'clock. And let's take a look at the evidence and see if it stacks up at all, if we have a match. Starting with, is there a sudden onset of destruction at the base of the building? Let's listen to Daryl, a medical student, interviewed that evening.
We were watching the building, actually, because it was on fire. The bottom floors of the building were on fire. And, we heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. Turned around, we were shocked to see that the building was, it looked like there was a shock wave ripping through the building, and the windows all busted out, and, it was horrifying. And then, about a second later, the bottom floor caved out, and the building followed after that, and we saw the building crash down all the way to the ground.
Wow. A shock wave ripping through the building, a sound of a clap of thunder, a windows busting out, and then the building coming down. So this is a pretty important order. We're hearing, seeing all this information in order. The building comes down. The building isn't causing these sounds. It seems to be something else, like explosions. We'll take a look at that. But let's first listen to Dan Rather as he describes for us the collapse of Building 7.
What you're seeing are high shots. Now, here we're going to show you a videotape of the collapse itself.
Describe that.
Now we go to videotape the collapse of this building.
It's amazing.
Amazing, incredible, pick your word. For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
Well, here's Dan using his intuition to try to report to the American people what he just saw. We should all be doing this. I should have done this using my intuition when I saw the Twin Towers collapsing 4 years ago. But I didn't have my wits about me, and neither did 80,000 other architects who were listening to the official story and the experts telling us, that was a collapse due to airplane impacts and fire. And Building 7, that never happened, really, is what they were telling us at the time. Straight down symmetrical collapse into its own footprint. How do we get that to happen? Let's take another look first. Is it straight down? Is it symmetrical? The penthouse drops a second prior to the overall collapse. We'll take one more look. What does that mean? That means the core columns had to have been taken out first, inside. And then, let's bring it back up. the largest controlled demolition, I think, in history, and perhaps the most, the largest. The Twin Towers weren't that controlled. They were somewhat out of control. So let's take a look. I'm not quite convinced yet. Side by side, a known controlled demolition on the right, Building 7 on the left. Is there any comparison? Is there enough similarity to warrant a new investigation into the possible use of explosives? Should it have been the first hypothesis that they looked at, given that every high-rise that's ever come down has come down due to explosive controlled demolition, and that no high-rise has ever come down due to fire? Come on, there's something seriously wrong. So column 79 is blamed because it's under the east penthouse, which drops about 6 seconds prior to the overall. So that's where the theory is. Now, when they came up with that theory, they had to let something go. And that was the damage out front on the south side, where, depending on who you talk to at the time, the damage was really bad, where they scooped out a whole section of the south face versus some minor damage. NIST basically discards the damage as a causative factor in the collapse of this building. They also discard the diesel fuel because, you know, there's no evidence, thick, dark, black smoke of diesel burning. And the diesel was on the fifth floor where the mechanical floor was, where the generators were, and it wasn't even on fire. So we have a very simple, they're forced into a very simple, they're forced into an explanation that's very simple for us to look at, and that's what we've been doing this morning, starting with those fires, which were out, according to NIST themselves in Appendix L, citing a photograph that says that those fires were out, not these particular ones, but these fires up here on the 12th floor near column 79. But in the draft report. But then they come back in the final report and said there's massive fires. And so on the south side, we have a lot of smoke. And I personally believe most all of that smoke's coming from Building 6, which was a really quite a terrible fire, and Building 5. And because you can see it's not coming out any of the windows, you know, except maybe one right here. None of those windows on this side. It's a negative air pressure effect. But I mean, there was some fires in the building too, but not this bad. So after about 3:45, and certainly by 4:45, these fires are out, and that pulls the rug out completely from the official story, because they're saying that. As you heard this morning, that the thermal expansion caused the internal failure, ultimately, of all of these nine floors, leaving this column nine floors high, and so finally it buckles, and then the whole thing falls apart from the inside. And the computer animation that you saw earlier, guess how many structural steel connections are failing per second in the 16 overall seconds of this building's collapse, in order for it to fall apart the way as fast as it needs to. 400 per second failing. This is a redundantly designed modern steel frame skyscraper. The connections are the strongest part of the building structure. They make sure that they are not the first to fail, right? So it makes no sense. Even if the chain of events that Kevin talked about and Tony this morning were true, you couldn't have the whole inside of the building failing like that without any telegraphing to the perimeter structure outside, because those beams and connections and columns are all very rigidly connected to that perimeter moment frame and braced frame system. It makes no sense at all. Architects and engineers get this immediately. Once you get them aware that there was the third worst structural failure in modern history that happened on 9/11 also. Then they're intrigued, right? You can start talking to them. And they're the ones that we need, like a whole lot more of them. Now, let's just say that it did happen. There's this internal failure. If you had an internal failure of a building, what would be the likelihood of the rest of the building failing like a house of cards as a result of that internal failure? Let's take a look at a couple of controlled demolitions that did fail and see how strong the rest of the building that wasn't exploded remains. Okay, is it going to fail? Look at these. If you don't blow that structure up completely, it's not going to go anywhere. And this is a real problem if you have one of these on your hands. You can't get insurance to fix that. You know, you're not going to be sending your construction workers into a building like that. Okay, you think that would fall into pieces all the way over, right? Okay, but no, ours falls straight down uniformly, symmetrically, free fall acceleration, straight down like a house of cards into this nice, neat pile where all the structural members are broken up. This is 47 stories, and yet it drops into a pile 4 or 5 stories high. There's no air in there. You know, everything's cut up. This is like your trash compactor. You know, it's very efficient. So how do we bring a building down? We have to remove those columns and demolition waves, starting with the interior structure, because remember you saw that penthouse come down a second earlier. So all those core columns have to be cut virtually simultaneously in order for this. In order for the penthouse to drop uniformly, symmetrically. Now, don't you think if there was some sort of interior caving in going on, like we saw, that you'd see that penthouse drop in pieces, in waves? No, it all drops at once. Now, can a fire remove all those columns virtually simultaneously? And then the perimeter columns after that. Is fire that precise? Those fires that you saw in particular, small isolated pockets of fires. No, doesn't make sense. How fast did this building come down? Well, let's understand something about free fall. This is a really important lesson. Let's go to the moon.
In my left hand, I have a feather. In my right hand, a hammer. And I guess one of the reasons we got here today was because of a gentleman named Galileo a long time ago, who made a rather significant discovery about falling objects in gravity fields. And we thought that where would be a better place to confirm his findings than on the moon. And so we thought we'd try it here for you. The feather happens to be appropriately a falcon feather for our falcon. And I'll drop the two of them here, and hopefully they'll hit the ground at the same time. How about that? Mr. Galileo was correct in his findings.
Okay, so we drop a hammer and a feather, and they land at the same time. Why? Because there's no resistance under the feather. There was, and what's the resistance here on this planet? Air. Okay, so how do we drop a building at free fall? We have to remove the resistance. That's the concept. So let's see how fast this building drops.
We can measure the downward acceleration of Building 7 by video frame analysis. I used a magnifying glass to place markers on the corner of the building on each frame. From this, we can get a data table and various graphs. The slope of this graph indicates acceleration, which is shown here to be about -10.279 plus or minus 0.6. Free fall in a vacuum is -9.8 in these units. That falls within the margin of error of this measurement. In other words, the rate of fall of Building 7 in the first few seconds is indistinguishable from free fall in a vacuum.
So NIST is forced by David Chandler and Stephen Jones to acknowledge, okay, you got me. The building came down at free fall. But that's consistent with our other analysis, so don't worry about it. This is the biggest fraudulent statement in the entire NIST report. This building is unresisted. You can see it gaining downward momentum. And that can only mean that those columns were removed. In fact, you can put it on the chart of drop distance versus time, and it's very clear. It's a free-falling object. Remember, you can't have an object free-falling and doing any other work. That's the definition of free-fall. Okay, this is free-fall. Just get this, because it took me a couple of years. You got to get it tonight. One, two, three. That brick dropped at free fall. What work was it capable of doing while it was going at 32 feet per second squared? Free fall. No work, okay? No work. Maybe moving some air out of the way. Virtually no work, okay? If it's gonna work and crush 40,000 tons of structural steel, what's it gonna do? It's gonna slow down. In fact, it's gonna stop, probably, right? Same thing in the Twin Towers. It could never, that collapse could never have even gotten started, and that in the Twin Towers and in Building 7 without help from explosives. These structures are enormously over-designed. And so, again, into a compressed pile, broken up, ready for loading and shipment. Remember, structures that fall due to natural forces, they're not dismembered. You can see what was, a building at one time. And resulting in minimal damage to adjacent structures, pretty good. This is actually quite a nice job for somebody. And do we have witnesses that hear sounds of explosions in Building 7? Here's Craig Bartmer, New York Police Department whistleblower.
And the whole time you hear him thoom, 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 thoom. So, I think I know an explosion when I hear it, you know? I was real close to Building 7 when it fell down, and I don't know, but that didn't sound like just a building falling down to me while I was running away from it. There's a lot of eyewitness testimony down there hearing explosions. I didn't see any reason for that building to fall down the way it did. And a lot of guys should be saying the same thing.
Well, here's another guy that's saying a similar thing. Kevin McPadden, Air Force medic, first responder. What does he say?
And then it was like another 2-3 seconds, you heard explosions. Like, ba-boom! It's like a distinct sound. It's not like when in compression, like boom, 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 boom. Like floors that were dropping and collapsing. This was ba-boom, and like you felt a rumble in the ground, like almost like you wanted to grab onto something. That, to me, I knew that was an explosion. There was no doubt in my mind.
Wow, that's pretty important. Now, they said explosions. We would have heard explosions, if there were like a bomb going off. Well, let's listen to this.
Yeah, here's one of the guys. He can tell you I'm okay, all right? Here, hold on. You want to call your mother or something?
I don't know what's happening in my videos.
Yeah, here's one of the guys. He can tell you I'm okay, all right? Here, hold on. You want to call your mother or something?
This is the afternoon of 9/11. None of these explosions are a part of the official story, and particularly the 118 that Graham McQueen documented through his research into the oral histories. What's happening? Why, the whole story has been reshaped. Most of this evidence has been ignored or covered up. How about those clouds? Let's see. What you can see racing down the street in every direction away from Building 7 as it's collapsing, after it's collapsing, these thick, billowing, enormous clouds very pyroclastic-like, fueled by the intense hot gases. Where are those gases coming from? Those few isolated pockets of fire that you saw? I don't think so. There's a whole lot more heat generated here, a lot more energy. Where did it come from? Well, wouldn't we expect to find chemical evidence of thermite cutter charges? Excuse me, of cutter charges of some kind in the building? Well, so far, this is direct evidence of explosive destruction. And guess what? Fire can't create any one of these. So we have lots of evidence. Why can't fire be responsible? Well, these buildings are fireproofed. They're protected 2 and 3 hours from fires and minimum. And so that's one of the reasons the thermal expansion couldn't even have happened in the first place. Another reason is even if they weren't fire protected, it wouldn't have happened, because what happens is the steel, as you saw in that test, it conducts the heat away from the source throughout the system. It's a huge heat sink, these steel frame buildings. It draws the heat away so that it never gets hot enough to reach that critical 1200 degree temperature that will weaken steel. And these office fires aren't even 1200 degrees. I don't even think NIST suggests that. Maybe 600, is it, Kevin? 600 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe. This is a fire. This is Building 5, World Trade Center, fully engulfed. You know, we're told Building 7, fully engulfed. No, this is a fully engulfed fire building. Did it collapse? No. Mid-rise structures don't collapse due to fires. High-rise structures don't collapse due to fires. Maybe this one did in China. It's 44 stories tall. Fully engulfed fire, right? I mean, you can't argue that that's not a fire. did it collapse? No. We have a before, we have an after. The building doesn't collapse. It just doesn't work like that. Yet on 9/11, Building 7 with these office fires and maybe a few more on the side, and a whole lot of smoke collapses overall in just 6.5 seconds into a pile like a house of cards. Makes no sense. So our background research delivered us a lot of information and informed us as to our hypothesis of explosive controlled demolition. We've done some, we're about right here, you know, we've done some good research, so now we can do some experiments. We'll be drawing on other experiments, in fact. With the Cardington tests, you don't have to do all the experiments from over again. So we've analyzed some results, we've drawn some conclusions, and so far, at least me, I'm leaning toward the hypothesis of controlled demolition, but we're not done yet. Let's take a look at the work that's been done by others relative to Building 7, FEMA, for instance, with a small team of volunteers and $600,000, which the engineers never got, with what they could only describe as a guided tour of the ground zero. They didn't have much flexibility to go and look at the steel or the blueprints. How do you even conduct an investigation under these circumstances? What did they find, though? Well, first of all, interestingly enough, who's doing this investigation? When we say a small team of volunteers, these are not your average PTA volunteers. It turns out that most of them have contracts, $10 million annual contracts, many of them, with defense contractors. And they all kind of appear through each of the successive, some of them, many of them appear through successive investigations, including informing the Popular Mechanics staff for their book. So we don't have, these are not independent verified, you know, they're trying to sell us something here that isn't true. It's not independent at all. But what do they say? The collapse of the World Trade Center 7 had a small debris field as the facade was pulled downward, suggesting internal failure and implosion. Wow. Does that look enough like a controlled demolition to you guys? Does it sound like one? They should be asking themselves. The specifics of the fires in World Trade Center 7 and how they caused the building to collapse remain unknown at this time. Wow, they just spent months or a year, and they don't even know how the building came down. You know, they're just like not able or not willing to make a better guess than fire. The best hypothesis, fire plus random damage, has only a low probability of occurrence. Maybe we should come up with a new hypothesis. You know, that's what you do when you're the results from your experiments and background research don't work. You come up with a new hypothesis. Construct a new one. Okay, did they do that? No. They say further research, investigation, and analysis are needed to resolve this issue. Unfortunately, though, for those hoping to resolve the issue, the steel, which they traditionally lay out and categorize and analyze as to figure out what happened to the building, the steel had instead been shipped to China for recycling at a rate of 400 truckloads a day. This is the illegal destruction of evidence, citing Bill Manning of a Fire Engineering magazine. The vehicle to which the fire protection engineers communicate with themselves and the larger community. He says crucial evidence that could answer many questions is on the slow boat to China. Whoa, showing an astounding ignorance of government officials to the value of a thorough scientific investigation. The destruction and removal of evidence must stop immediately. Did it? No. Now, what does Jonathan Barnett, who was on the FEMA team, have to say about that evidence?
Normally, when you have a structural failure, you carefully go through the debris field, looking at each item, photographing every beam as it collapsed and every column where it is in the ground, and you pick them up very carefully and you look at each element. We were unable to do that in the case of Tower 7.
How come? Oh, you destroyed the evidence before the report came out. What kind of scientific method is FEMA using? If the evidence contradicts your fire hypothesis, destroy it. Well, and here's Mayor Bloomberg, who was an engineer, saying just looking at a piece of steel generally doesn't tell you anything. That's the justification for the destruction of evidence. The 9/11 Commission, of course, would hopefully give us some accounting for the collapse of Building 7. No, not one page in the entire report mentions the destruction of this building, the third worst structural failure in modern history. Is this one of the reasons Max Cleland resigns from the commission, citing it's a national scandal? The investigation is now compromised. Maybe. What do the experts say? Well, here's Danny Jewenko, top controlled demolition expert in Europe. What is 27 years? It starts from below. They've simply blown away the columns. It's a controlled demolition. A team of experts did this. It's professional work, without a doubt. Wow. What does Hugo Bachmann say, chairman of the Department of Structural Dynamics, Swiss Federal Institute of Technology? In my opinion, the building World Trade Center 7 was with great probability professionally demolished. And Kamal Obaid, one of 45 to 55 structural engineers we now have signed on to our petition calling for a new investigation, he says, a localized failure in a steel frame building like World Trade Center 7 cannot cause a catastrophic collapse like a house of cards without a simultaneous and patterned loss of several of its columns at key locations within the building. Pretty important. And back to Jonathan Barnett.
We were surprised that Tower 7 collapsed, we being the team that investigated what occurred on that day.
Yes, thank you. We were too. Do we have foreknowledge? You heard some foreknowledge earlier. Here's some more. Take a look at these mysterious construction workers and this police officer caught on CNN television. Now, you're going to hear an explosion, and then the construction worker turns around and says, "Did you hear that? Keep your eye on that building. That building's coming down." Hey.
At the last few seconds, he...
Not right.
Keep your eye on that building. It'll be coming down.
The building is about to blow up. Move it back.
All right, guys.
We are walking back. There's a building about to blow up. On flame. Debris coming down.
The building's about to blow up, the police officer says. That's why we're walking back. Flame and debris coming down. How does he know this? I mean, there's a few fires in the building. And they're not putting it out. The firemen are told not to put out the fire. They're scratching their heads, waiting, as we heard this morning. And who are these construction workers? And these are not rescue workers. Who's doing construction in the afternoon of 9/11, walking away from Building 7 minutes before it blows up, knowing it's going to blow up? Okay. We want somebody to investigate that gentleman. And what did Kevin McPadden hear before he was talking about those explosions you heard earlier? That he had been moved back to this 0.5 blocks away, as you had heard. He's listening to a Red Cross worker with a radio. And what does he hear?
At the last few seconds, he took his hand off, and you heard 3, 2, 1.
3, 2, 1. Do buildings come down? Do fires bring buildings down? The countdowns? That would be a first. Okay, well, CNN did even better than the BBC. Here at 10:45, well, at 11:07, they're announcing what happened at 10:45. Listen.
In New York, Alan Dobbs Frank joins us on the phone in Lower Manhattan. Alan.
Aaron, just 2 or 3 minutes ago, there was yet another collapse or explosion. I'm now out of sight. A Good Samaritan has taken me in on Duane Street. But at 10:45, there was another collapse or explosion following the 10:30 collapse of the second tower. And a firefighter who rushed by us estimated that 50 stories went down. The street filled with smoke. It was like a fire, forest fire roaring down a canyon. Now, as I think Patty Sabgen and others have told you...
50-story building went down, the fireman said. Wait a minute, there was no other 50-story building that went down. The Twin Towers had just gone down. Was Building 7 supposed to have gone down at 10:45? Had it done so, they would have been obscured in the massive dust and debris cloud from the Twin Towers that had just collapsed. Did something go wrong? Is this why they're waiting all day for it to come down? You know, maybe it was supposed to be collateral damage. And we might not have ever questioned it like we are today because we have these beautiful videos of it. Well, except for the bottom two on the left, we have lots of evidence for direct evidence of explosives. Again, fire can't create any one of those, let alone all of them. With additional corroborating evidence, is this proof to you of explosive controlled demolition? Would this be proof to your friends who don't believe you if only you could get them to sit down and watch this DVD for 10 minutes, 30 minutes, 60 minutes, or, God forbid, 2 hours? We have all those options for you out on the table. So pick the attention span of your prospective candidate. In many cases, it might just be 10 minutes, in which case they'll get what you just heard in a rapid fashion. Now, who was in this building? The CIA, the Secret Service, the IRS, Department of Defense, Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management, the SEC, which lost thousands of files related to hundreds of cases it was actively pursuing against Wall Street companies like Enron and WorldCom. Is it reasonable that Al-Qaeda could have had access to this building to plant explosive charges. Maybe not. That's why many of us tend to favor the hypothesis of explosive controlled demolition by somebody from the inside. This is why we call it an inside job, although we don't like to use that term at AE 911 Truth. The conclusions are pretty inescapable to those of us who are thinking. But we just present the evidence and we let our prospective candidate with the open mind come to his own conclusions about this stuff. We don't force feed people with this. It's extremely difficult. So this is why we put up a third beam of light in New York on 9/11 when the Twin Towers, the memorial beams for the Twin Towers went up, because we want people to be aware that there was a third skyscraper and that that third skyscraper is the key to the justice of the awareness and getting justice for the victims and the lives lost on 9/11 in the Twin Towers. So we're doing everything we can. And by the way, you can sign up for our free email newsletter. Also, the sign-up sheets on our bookstore, in our bookstore, at the table outside. It comes every 2 weeks, and we keep you informed as to what's going on. If you've already signed the petition, you should be getting the newsletter anyway. Now, let's take a look at those other two. Is there evidence of cutter charges? Well, first of all, molten metal we heard about. What does that mean? What's going on here? Well, we're not talking about the Twin Towers tonight, so we'll jump straight to the evidence as told by the first responders, the iron workers, the structural engineers, like this one. Who says this? As of 21 days after the attack, fires were still burning and molten metal was still running. None other than Leslie Robertson, a structural engineer responsible for the design of the Twin Towers himself. He said, in fact, in a separate quote, he says, a little river of steel flowing is what he saw down there when the firefighters pulled away this piece of concrete. And there's a video of that, which is new from the recent FOIA request by the International Center for 9/11 Studies. We have so many videos as a result of the release from NIST because of that FOIA request, and that was one of them. And his associate, Leslie Robertson's associate, Rich Garlock, says that the debris past the columns was red hot, molten, running. Fires burned and molten metal flowed, says this urban search and rescue worker. A red hot steel being pulled from deep within the pile. And the first responders, what do they say? Here's Peter Tully, president of the cleanup company. Is he credible? He saw pools of literally molten steel, dripping from the molten steel. Steel flowed in molten streams. Seeing the molten steel, uncovering red hot metal beams, red hot weeks after the events, molten metal. Molten steel at the heart of the towers remains. Molten steel beams. Metal that leaked to hot cores and flowed down the broken walls. Molten metal dripping from a beam. The end of the beam would be dripping with molten steel. Why, by the way, are the ends of these beams dripping with molten steel? This is a steel beam. This is documented by a structural engineer who had exclusive access to much of this steel at the piles, Abulhazen Astani from UC Berkeley. He's documenting the melting of this beam. Now, he's not smart enough to understand that fires don't melt beams, and neither does jet fuel. Okay? Because I've talked to him personally. Now, I'm not smart enough to understand some of the things he knows about structural engineering, just to be fair, but I mean, this is really not that difficult. He says, oh, that's not my area. I'm not a fire specialist. People want to stay in their own sphere of influence and apply all of the other answers that are common sense to experts outside themselves. This is part of what we have inherited from the control of our media, I suppose. So hot that molten metal dripped down the sides of the wall. Heat that does these kinds of warped formations, that you can't get this kind of heat from office fires or jet fuel. Now, FEMA documents what? In their Appendix C in the NIST report. Let's take a look. This is extraordinary. Intergranular melting, capable of turning solid steel girder into Swiss cheese, like this piece here. They've never seen office fires do this. And you could pour all the jet fuel on a piece of steel for all length of time, and you'll never see it melt like this. Rapid oxidation, sulfidation. There's no answers for these things. Well, they have answers. They say, well, gypsum board has calcium sulfate in it, so maybe the calcium sulfate leached out and attacked the steel. Well, gypsum board is used to protect steel from fires, and never before in history in the last 100 years have we had a sulfur corrosion attack on the steel it's designed to protect. Okay, so these are the kind of answers we get back from debunkers and official NIST spokespeople, and they make no sense. And by the way, there was sulfur completely engulfing the air on the site. John Feel, who worked on the site, says, every time I tried to breathe in, it burned, that smell of sulfur and everything else. Well, where's the sulfur coming from if it's not from the gypsum board? Sulfur is added to thermite, an incendiary, which we'll be talking about, to become thermate. Maybe it came from there. Here's molten iron. Not molten steel, but molten iron. FEMA themselves documents the molten iron. Okay? So it's not like the steel heated up in a pile down there. That's not where the iron came from. The steel doesn't give up its iron. Steel is an alloy. We're talking about elemental iron. It's different. We haven't used iron in steel structures, iron beams and columns, for 100 years. It's too brittle, so they add all of these alloys to it now. What kind of scientific method is NIST using? If the data doesn't support your fire hypothesis, hide it, the evidence of molten metal. But what does John, we're coming to John, liquid molten metal falling out of the debris held in the jaws of this crab claw tractor. And what do they find after all of this material is cooled?
One of the more unusual artifacts to emerge from the rubble is this rock-like object that has come to be known as the meteorite.
It's this fused element of steel, molten steel and concrete and all of these things all fused by the heat.
And architects, engineers, people who work with steel, welders have just never seen the level of destruction and the level of deformation of this material in our lives.
Well, and it's not aluminum from the jet planes because, you know, aluminum doesn't rust, strike one against aluminum, right? And let's take a look at the infrared satellite photos. Here's Building 7. We have 1,300 degree temperatures on the surface a week after 9/11. Now, 1,300 degree temperatures are associated with the hottest of office fires. But guess what? And here's the South Tower, and here's the North Tower. We don't have office fires going on the surface of Ground Zero after the collapse. So where in the heck are all of these, where is this heat coming from? It's radiating from down below in the debris piles. Well, if it's 1,300 degrees on the surface, how hot is it down at the source? These are the molten metal. Now, the molten iron, what it turned out to be, pools that they were seeing, which surely was twice that temperature. Now, let's just try to get an understanding of what those supporting and being the spokespeople for the official stories say about all this molten metal.
First of all, let's go back to your basic premise that there was a pool of molten steel. I know of absolutely nobody, no eyewitness who said so, nobody who's produced it.
You'd get down below and you'd see molten steel, molten steel running down the channel rails. Like you're in a foundry.
Like lava
from
a volcano.
There's no eyewitness who said so.
There are actually melted beams where it was molten steel that was being dug out.
Underground, it was still so hot that molten metal dripped down the sides of a wall.
And the cleanup was very difficult. The steel was coming out red in certain areas from the first couple of weeks at least.
Nobody who's produced it.
This fused element of steel, molten steel.
Nobody who's produced it. Nobody who's produced it. I know of absolutely nobody, no eyewitness who said so, nobody who's produced it.
So we have a problem, don't we? Somebody appears to be lying. Maybe it's all those firefighters and engineers. I'm not sure. You got to decide for yourself. But if it were this gentleman, John Gross, co-project leader of the NIST report, why would he be doing that? Because could it be because the official report cannot possibly account for even half, really, of the temperatures required to melt steel or to produce molten iron? They're caught between a rock and a hard place. What we're looking at is a deceptive controlled demolition. They tried to avoid the loud bangs and the bright flashes of traditional high-energy explosives like C4 and RDX, but they end up with a big problem, pools of molten iron that they can't explain, so they just deny. Now, the fires may have gotten 1,200 degrees, according to Thomas Iger. NIST claims 1,800 degrees without any evidence whatsoever. Here's the problem. The steel doesn't melt, and iron doesn't melt until 2,700 degrees. It begins to melt. What could possibly account for that? We'll be looking at thermite and as a source, which produces molten iron at 4,500 degrees. What about all that? John Gross, if the data doesn't support your fire hypothesis, the molten steel, iron in this case, deny that it exists. That's the kind of, that's where your tax dollars are going in this $20 million report. So if nothing else has made you angry yet, maybe the misuse of these funds would help. The last fire wasn't even extinguished until 3 months after 9/11. They couldn't put it out. Tom Manley says it was like you were creating a giant lake, all this water. Well, thermite contains its own source of oxygen. It burns just as well underwater. Maybe that's why they couldn't put it out. But is there evidence of the chemical evidence of thermite? And what is thermite anyway?
An incendiary used by the military, thermite is a compound of iron oxide and aluminum, which when ignited sustains an extreme heat reaction, creating molten iron. In just 2 seconds, thermite can reach temperatures over 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit, quite enough to liquefy steel. We know that open-air fires cannot burn hot enough to melt steel, but metal had melted at the base of the towers. Appendix C of the FEMA report describes sulfur residues on the World Trade Center steel. The New York Times called this the deepest mystery of all. Sulfur slightly lowers the melting point of iron, and iron oxide and iron sulfide had formed on the surface of the structural steel. Sulfur used with thermite is called thermate, producing even faster results.
This is important background research. We would have liked to have seen FEMA and NIST include this in the application of their scientific method. NFPA 21 is the guide for fire and explosion investigation. It is a standard, the version that was in effect on at 9/11/01. It says unusual residues could arise from thermite, magnesium, or pyrotechnic materials. NIST acknowledges, of course, that it hasn't looked for this, and first after saying they never found it, and they refuse to still look for it, despite this evidence, which has been handed to them and every member of Congress and the Senate, too, by the way. Well, Dr. Stephen Jones, a physicist formerly from Brigham Young University, does some analysis, background research, once again, beforehand. If thermite were used, you'd have a characteristic burn pattern, a white-yellow hot liquid metal, an intense white reaction zone. We would be looking for those kind of things, like pouring out of the side of the Twin Tower, the South Tower, 10 minutes prior to its collapse. Other elements like iron, aluminum, copper, calcium, silicon, fluorine, and manganese, very unusual elements. So if you have these, you can be pretty sure that you're on the right track to uncovering thermite. Well, here's a piece of molten metal. It was molten metal anyway. Now it's solidified. He analyzes a chunk from this. What does he find? It's not aluminum from the jet plane, and it's not steel. It's molten iron, confirming the results of FEMA's Appendix C. It has abundant manganese in it. This proves that it's not melted steel, by the way. It has aluminum, sulfur, potassium, key ingredients, essential ingredients for thermite. Manganese and fluorine in abundance. This is extraordinary. This has been given to NIST as well. They won't follow up. Potassium permanganate creates manganese. It's an oxidizer in thermite. Sol gels use fluorine. Sol gel is a very special form of thermite. So these together are clearly a thermite fingerprint in this piece alone. Then he's given some slag from the end of this beam at Clarkston University by the sculptor. And here it is here. He does X-ray fluorescence. He finds what? Iron, sulfur, potassium, manganese. Separate, complete test. Finding all of those elements in the International Peace Park from this beam, which you can see the aluminum cut across this beam, intermixed with the cut. And yes, indeed, he finds in this third piece, aluminum, silica, oxygen, iron. Now, gel explosives, if they were used, and the fluorine suggests that they were, they're very powerful, made of smaller powders of iron oxide and aluminum powder. They can be packed into a cutter charge designed specifically for thermite, patented well before 9/11, and they can eject liquid molten iron in milliseconds, cutting through steel even more efficiently than high-energy explosives. So that's really important to keep in mind, but this is even more important. This device here is made, the casing itself is made of consolidated thermite. I don't know why, but the result is that the whole thing melts into molten iron. There's no casings left behind, which is a common objection put forth by debunkers. Oh, they would have found miles of det cord in casings. No, not necessarily. What else do they find in the air at 9/11? 1,3-diphenylpropane. This would be left behind with sol gels. EPA finds this molecule at levels that dwarf all others. In fact, Eric Schwartz says, we've never observed it in any other sampling we've done. Where the heck did it come from? Well, it didn't come from plastics and computers in offices because they've never found it in the samplings from those fires. So, is there evidence of thermite in the World Trade Center dust? This is pretty interesting. Dr. Jones is given samples from four different samples, and he's a scientist, right? A nuclear physicist, and a physicist. He puts the magnet to them. What comes up to the magnet? I don't know why he did this in the first place or thought of it, but I'm glad he did, because in this dust which blanketed Lower Manhattan 4 to 12 inches thick, he and the USGS separately find what amounts to billions of these previously molten iron microspheres. Okay, so this is yet another finding by officials of molten iron in their samplings, you know? And Dr. Jones finds it also. Now, how would we get billions of previously molten iron microspheres? Well, if you had thousands of thermite cutter charges laced throughout the columns and beams in Building 7 and or the World Trade Center Twin Towers, and under explosive conditions, you would have the atomization of this byproduct of thermite being liquid, molten iron. What happens to a liquid when it's atomized? It forms tens of thousands, billions, just right here. Of what? Spheres. Why? Because the surface tension forms itself into a sphere, a liquid, when it's atomized. That's just what it does. So if this were liquid molten iron, under that pressure of explosives, it could be that small, about the diameter of a human hair, most of them, and they cool and fall with all of the dust. This, by the way, is the only rational reason, I think, that all those cars were toasted, that some people think came from some exotic weapon. This is a reasonable hypothesis to consider. So there aren't very many others, by the way. They say, oh, it came from the cleanup equipment. Well, these samples were collected on top of the Deutsche Bank building by the USGS, in which they found up to 6% or 5% of the volume of this dust was these spheres. Now, that's right across the street from the Twin Towers, but other samples were collected. One was collected on the Brooklyn Bridge just 10 minutes after the collapse of the building by somebody who turned that over to Dr. Jones in that case. So it didn't have cleanup equipment, welding torches. It's not polluted like that. So R.J. Lee, environmental firm, finds previously molten iron microspheres in their dust samples as well. They document it. They have no reason. They don't even speculate as to where these might come from, which is curious enough in itself. What's your best guess, people, of where these spheres came from? They don't even provide that. It's so common that they use it as a signature element. In other words, it's not World Trade Center dust unless it has those spheres. Okay, that's really important.
So molten iron is sprayed into the air from the thermite reaction. It forms into a sphere roughly due to surface tension, and those solidify in the air. And so that, all that information is preserved in the dust. And we then look at the dust and are learning a great deal about what happened.
Pretty important findings. Now, what's the chemical makeup of this? Pretty interesting. It turns out to be the same chemical makeup of spheres which are produced from thermite. The USGS does this examination as well. We'll come back to that. But what else is in the dust? Dr. Jones says to himself, well, could there be any unignited thermite? That should come up to the magnet too. Because why? The unignited thermite would have iron oxide, which is basically rust, along with aluminum. Does it come up? He may have missed it the first time. He did. They're red-gray chips, red on one side, gray on the other, about a 16th of an inch long, most of them are the biggest ones. And let's take a look. These are really curious, multi-layered chips. Oh, maybe they're paint. So he does some investigative work. He applies the scientific method. He does an analysis of them. They're iron, oxygen, aluminum, silica. My God, the ingredients of thermite, lo and behold. So He cuts one open, puts it under electron microscope, zooms in 50,000 times, and what does he see? Well, he sees these rhomboidal crystalline iron oxide particles 40 nanometers across. What's that? That's 1,000 times smaller than a human hair diameter. You know, that's so small, it's inconceivable. And it's extremely sophisticated process required to manufacture that, to mix it intimately with the aluminum wafers that you have here that are a little larger, and set them, intimately mix them in the perfect proportion to become thermite, which is what we have here, 1/4 to 3/4. Set them in organic bed of oxygen, silicon, carbon, which, by the way, would do gas pressure work, in other words, explosive. Not only do we have an explosive quality due to the small particles, which increases the surface area dramatically, which increases the reaction time, which means that not only is it's not just an incendiary anymore, it's acting like an explosive. These can be highly engineered. This is a very sophisticated material. And guess what? They kind of blow up in the heater at about 420 degrees centigrade, 900, 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. They ignite. I wonder what happens when they ignite. They produce spheres, molten iron spheres. I wonder what the chemical analysis of those spheres are. Oh, the exact same chemical analysis of the spheres that USGS found in the World Trade Center dust. This is an airtight case. There's no room for argument here. In fact, the spheres are attached to the partially ignited chips as well. So we know darn well, you know, where they came from. This is documented in Lawrence Livermore Lab, Los Alamos Lab, before 9/11. Guess what, folks? This is not made in a cave in Afghanistan. It's among the most sophisticated materials made by the defense contracting industry. So how about an investigation that finds out who can make this stuff? Interestingly enough, Kevin Ryan documents that the lead investigators across some of the NIST committees are themselves experts in the development of nanothermite. They've put the fox in charge of the hen house relative to this investigation. Maybe that's the reason we didn't have an investigation into the possible use of explosives, least of all nanocomposite thermite, which, as you can see, is quite a process. Now, we're going to spend the next 2 hours going through this process. So, okay, now you got some homework to do. This is documented in a 24-page peer-reviewed paper in the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal. It remains uncontested over the last year and a half. Nobody's put forth a paper. They just say, oh, it's paint, you know, or that's the one we hear the most. And paint doesn't have the properties that you now know that nanothermite has. So we have molten iron found in pools throughout the World Trade Center. We have melted steel beams like Swiss cheese. We know that jet fuel can't create any of this molten phenomena. We have iron-rich microspheres, which take 3,000 degrees to melt. By the way, when did those iron microspheres get formed? During the event. So we have molten iron pouring out of the South Tower before the event. We have molten iron created during the event. And after the event, we have these melted steel beams. Before, during, and after. We have red-gray chips found in the World Trade Center dust, which should not be there. This is pretty damning evidence to the official story. Let's talk about those who avoided this evidence. NFPA 921 requires the investigation to be free of conflicts of interest. Do we have any conflicts of interest? I think we noted just now. Most of these people working on these investigations have defense contracting contracts with those with that industry, and many of them worked all the way through each one of these investigations, including SAIC, Advanced Research Associates, individuals like Foreman Williams, Stephen Margolis, experts in the development of nanothermite. So let's get an investigation which includes these people. Now, relative to Building 7, which we've been looking at, we seem to have all of the evidence of explosive controlled demolition. And that's pretty much direct evidence. Fire can't account for any of it. The experts agree, most of them, the ones who are not working for the federal government, depending on them for their paycheck, like most of the controlled demolition companies in the United States. This is proof of controlled demolition, I believe, beyond a reasonable doubt, at any rate. So we're asking you to join us if that's your conclusion as well. Sign our petition at AE911Truth online. In fact, I need some help. Who will help me? We meant to give you brochures as you came in here so you could follow along, and I forgot. So who would volunteer to go out to the store, get the brochures from Tony, bring them in, and pass them out? Could I have four hands? Those. Oh, thank God. Never mind. So you have in there a petition. You can sign it today or go online. Now, what's the problem with this information? This messes with our worldview. Most of us, like me, your Ronald Reagan Republican, don't want to face the consequences of a belief system that for decades, even if you're on the left, okay, we have faith in our government. We have faith that something like this couldn't happen, an inside job like this couldn't happen in our country. It's not supposed to. How many of you went through some serious changes mentally, emotionally, with this material? How many of you are still going through those changes? It's not easy, right? We need to talk this out. And that's one of the reasons we gather. We get emotional camaraderie, support at coming to events like this, meeting regularly, weekly, monthly, with your local 9/11 truth groups, being out on the street and finding somebody that comes along to take your literature that actually says, oh yeah, I heard something about that, tell me more. That may not be most of what you experience on the street, but it is almost healing for me when it happens, because I'm out there too, so I know. So what we don't want you to do is this chain of events. Go into paralysis, just kind of deny it. Come up with a bunch of questions that you use to avoid answering these them. I couldn't have happened. I would have heard about it by now. Our government wouldn't do this to us. Of course, we're not saying your government did it. We don't know who did it. We're architects and engineers. We're just saying something bad, right, happened here. Let's deal with it. Let's have a real investigation. Don't avoid the debate. Go back to sleep and continue becoming part of this problem. We've got to take another track. We're going to need to get motivated and take action. And based on a rational reaction to this scientific data, you can use your mind to help your emotions kind of catch up. But what some people do, even though they'll see the forensic-based science evidence, they won't be able to do anything with it because they're blocked emotionally. 80 to 90% of our reality is emotion-based. Has nothing to do with reactions. If you want to test that theory, walk into a mall and find yourself buying something that you don't need. It's all based on emotions. Work through our fears, our disbeliefs, our mindsets, and get informed and help find other architects, engineers, media officials, government officials, so we can get an investigation, which in turn will wake up the sleeping American public. After all, we're not alone. I mean, we have hundreds of survivors and family members demanding a new investigation. Military intelligence, law enforcement, government officials, distinguished academic professors, entertainment media professionals, pilots and aviation officials, former heads of state and defense ministers like in West Germany, the former president of Italy, the former defense minister of Canada, and Senator Fujita in Japan, all demanding a new investigation. So it's not going to be that difficult as we gather more and more, like Geraldo, for whatever reason, coming out and supporting us for 10 minutes. Thank you. and disappearing, crawling back into his I won't say anything bad about Geraldo. I want to be on his show. We'll take questions in a moment. Why didn't we see the truth about 9/11? Well, it appears as if our government lied to us about these building collapses, right? The 9/11 Commission reinforced that lie. FEMA and NIST justified it, and the corporate media repeated it, and they hammered it in. We were fooled. Now, we've seen that explosives were used to destroy Building 7, but of course it takes months of planning, advanced planning, to engineer in place these explosives. It doesn't happen in an afternoon. Who had the means, the motive, the opportunity to engage in this crime? Who benefited? These are the questions that enterprising journalists should be asking who are doing their real job. But as you've heard earlier this afternoon, they're apparently not, so you and me have to. The architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth don't speculate about these issues. We don't have conspiracy theories. So unfortunately, this is just the beginning of, admittedly, a disturbing but very essential opportunity for you, a creative challenge to go back and understand 9/11. Our purpose here is to inform you and to inspire you to join in the creating a groundswell of public outrage and action to obtain a real investigation. I hope that you will feel compelled to take action. The evidence you've seen tonight is just a small fraction of that which is available and put together of the vast body of information by the 9/11 Truth Movement. The questions raised are numerous and ominous that must be answered in a real investigation. So what do we have to do? Follow up. We've got homework. We have a DVD. It can be very helpful. Again, 10 minutes, 30 minutes, 60 minutes. You can get both of these DVDs for just $30, by the way, or $20 each. One is 2 hours. The other one is 10-minute, 30-minute, and 60-minute, and includes David Chandler's excellent analysis. Physics analysis. You can buy these in bulk for as little as $1.50 each. So you can hand them out to friends. There's some excellent books that have been written. Highly recommend David Ray Griffin's book on Building 7, The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7. You can get those at our website, ae911truth.org. But demand a question, demand answers. We got enough questions. And write your television, radio station, TV, newspapers, letters to the editor. There's so much that you can do, even with just email, by sending the introduction letter from our website. Go to downloads, and you'll find that letter there. And it's 3 pages of great evidence. You can also send them the brochure and the 9/11 investigator, links to all of these important, easy to look at, easy to read, and fairly easy to understand. This is not difficult stuff. It is not advanced physics. You don't have to be intimidated by it. And sign our petition. Stand up and be counted. Everyone can sign, not just architects and engineers. Just go right here on our website and volunteer for us. We have 20 different committees that you can help on. particularly if you're a web designer. We need you. We need your help today. And become a sustaining supporter of architects and engineers. As I mentioned earlier this morning, $10 to $25 to $100 a month can make a huge difference for us in putting ads in the local engineering magazines, in hiring our publicist to do work that is really critical for us to do. Your donation is tax deductible. I think we're the only 501c3 associated with the 9/11 Truth Movement. So we'll be happy to make sure that you have a tax-deductible donation. So go to our website and donate there. And for sure, leave put a check, for goodness sakes, into the envelope that you have in your hands when you get home. It'll be of great help to us. Follow your conscience mostly and act. After all, we may not have the luxury of time. If they, whoever they are, planned and executed 9/11, they can plan and execute another one. And curiously enough, even Zbigniew Brzezinski himself, former national security advisor, actually warned the U.S. Senate in February of 2007 about such a future false flag attack against Iran in order to allow us to invade Iran. I don't know why these people blow the whistle on each other. I don't understand their internal dynamics. I don't think I want to. I just want to blow the whistle on all of them, okay? That's what we're doing here. The whistle, we have the biggest whistle at AE 9/11 Truth because we have 25,000 years of technical credibility that you can rely on to get your message across to those thick-headed family members and colleagues and architects and engineers. That's what we'll have more of, by the way, if we allow the truth about 9/11 to be swept under the rug of history. More false flag attacks on Americans, more wars around the world with millions more killed, more economic manipulation, worsening financial crisis, more loss of civil liberties, and we become a whole lot less safe. Whereas the truth about 9/11 illuminates these lies and results in the rectification of each of these disasters. So please, it's not too late to discover for yourself where you draw your line in the sand. Do you wait for the next 9/11? Predicted by members of the Congress and the media to be far worse than the last. No. Speak out now, for a time comes when your silence is betrayal. Thank you so very much. Thank you. Thank you. Now you know what to do. Damon? Oh, man.
Well, first.
Yep, I'm done.
I want to just mention that there was a donation given today in cash for Building Watt, and that is supposed to go to you.
Oh.
Since Architects and Engineers is the group that's collecting the money.
Yes, you can make your donation out to buildingwatt.org, and it'll flow through us. If you want to support Architects and Engineers, you can do that. But tonight we're encouraging you to support buildingwatt.org.
Testing.
So and make your check out to Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Put in the little reminder
in the notes,
buildingwatt.org. Hopefully that's not too confusing.
Thank you.
Yeah, working.